This is Trackside with Kirk Cavan and Kevin Lee.
Good morning, everyone. Greeting you on behalf of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and thanking you for your attendance.
Stay tuned for the greatest spectacle in racing.
Gentlemen, start your engines.
A.J. Foyt down the main straightaway. The checkered flag is out. A.J.'s hand in the air. He is the winner. A.J. Foyt at Indianapolis has won his fourth 500-mile race. Gordon Johncock off the fourth turn. Mears is right behind him. Mears makes a try. Johncock wins it by less than one-tenth of a second.
Danny Sullivan gets him. No, he's squirreling. No, he's spinning. Danny Sullivan spins. But he goes around twice and gathers it.
Absolutely incredible.
They're side by side. Emo on the inside. Alcon in traffic. Goes high. They touch wheels. Oh. Al Jr. into the wall hard.
Now, stay tuned for the greatest spectacle in racing.
The crowd roaring. Rick Mears heads toward number four. He's down the main straightaway. Here's Bob Jenkins.
Rick Mears becomes the third four-time winner of the Indianapolis 500, winning the Diamond Jubilee Edition, the 75th running of this great speed class.
And he's on.
Al Unser Jr. has the lead. One more turn to go. Bob Jenkins, who's going to win it?
The checkered flag is out. Goodyear makes a move. Little Al wins by just a few tenths of a second.
You just don't know what Indy means.
Stay tuned for the greatest spectacle in racing.
Can a teenager win in Indianapolis?
Sam Ornish Jr. makes the pass. He'll win it. Sam Ornish Jr. goes to the inside of Marco Andretti and wins it in the final 100 yards.
It's a new track record.
J.R. Hildebrand down along the white line. He is sputtering slow and he hits the wall. He hits the wall coming out of four.
Now stay tuned for the greatest spectacle in racing.
Felio Castro Neves making that car plenty wide. Tucks right in behind him. Almost got into the grass to make the pass. Ryan Hunter Ray with a bonsai move in the entrance to three. Back in front of Indianapolis.
He may have to coast it across the finish line. Alexander Rossi almost rolling to a dead stop. Quick checkers are out and the rookie will win the 100th Indianapolis 500-mile race.
How I long for my Indiana home.
It's May in Indianapolis, or in Avon, Indiana, where we're broadcasting from tonight, but specifically we'll go with Indianapolis. Thanks for joining us, Trackside 93.5, 107.5, The Fan. Highlights of classic Indianapolis 500 calls put together and edited by our former producer, David Deering. David posted that on Twitter this week on a YouTube channel. So I said, David, we are going to repurpose that tonight. So thanks to David, and we've already got a few others lined up. We'll make it as feel... I'm not going to say we'll make it feel like a normal month of May, but we'll try to give you good memories here of the next few weeks, and then we hope that we can do that again coming up in the summertime a little later on, and we'll probably get a little more insight on that and some other topics a little later on in the show tonight. Mark Miles, the CEO of Penske Entertainment, will talk to us. We'll also discuss the end of the official IndyCar iRacing Challenge and all the controversies and who's mad at who. And as the country begins to cautiously reopen in phases, all eyes now on motorsports as one of the first in the live entertainment business to resume with major changes. We'll get into that tonight on the program too. Kevin Lee, Kurt Cavan, Brad Huber is in our Indianapolis studios at MS Communications. Kurt, I should also mention, trying to make it feel, or at least give us something good to feel about in the month of May, Donald Davidson will be with us on Thursday night, 6 to 7, the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Donald's show will run weekly, every Thursday night at 6 in the month of May. I honestly don't know if that continues to the last Thursday in May, which would have been after the running of the 500 is scheduled. So we'll just hope that they don't notice, and we'll get a bonus weekend. And then Donald will be back with us, I'm sure, at a point in July and in August, and much more. I think we'll have to start before we get into some of the things that have been happening in IndyCar, and there are notes there, but it really begins with NASCAR. They're the first to come back. Things have been made official. What have we learned since we last spoke on Tuesday as to NASCAR's plans?
Well, they're going to run not only soon, but a lot in the next few weeks. It's something like, you may have the number in front of you, like 7 race dates in like 11 days or something silly like that with Xfinity and the trucks. So you mix actually just Xfinity, I think, in Cup. Is there trucks?
There's one truck race scheduled in that 11-day span that includes 7 races and 4 Cup races basically over 2 weekends.
And, you know, they focus primarily on the Southeast. So, you know, Darlington and Charlotte in particular. They've got Atlanta in their future. You know, I think they're wise. It wouldn't have been one of the strategies that I initially came up with a month or so ago when I thought about races. I thought they would just run where they could. And, for example, if Texas was opening up sooner than, say, Georgia, that they would go to Texas. But they are focusing on a regional series at this point, which makes it easier for people just to get in their – Not everyone, but it makes it easier for the largest percentage of their employees and crew members, et cetera, to jump in a car and drive to venues as opposed to relying on commercial or private aircraft. You know, so if I'd have to think that if they were to be racing in California here in the next few weeks, that would be scrapped. And I mean, they didn't have any California races in May or June until Sonoma at the end of June. But my point is they've kept it local as best they can, and they're going to try to get as many races in as they can. I think this is a good strategy. I do think that it'll be an interesting case study in terms of television numbers. You know, are we that desperate to watch that many races? I don't know. I mean, we've been a racing society that you know, goes with, you know, one Cup race a weekend. And you know, certainly a Friday, Saturday, Sunday platform for NASCAR. And then when IndyCar is mixed in, but be a lot of races to watch. We'll see if what the appetite is for that many and that many in succession.
And from a television standpoint, it is the grand experiment. We're going to see a couple of Wednesday night races just to begin things. It starts in a week and a half at Darlington. Then they'll run at Darlington on the following Wednesday. After the Coca-Cola 600, they'll run at Charlotte again on a Wednesday without competition. So I think you may have some that stumble upon it. Ultimately, there are going to be some people that are just saying, you know, I'm not interested in a car race under any circumstances. But what I think you can do is you can get all of the people, or more of them than you normally can, that have some interest in a race. There's no other racing competition in that time frame, and there's no other competition from family events for the race fans. So I think you are going to see the number go up. It's not going to triple or quadruple or anything like that, but it's going to be higher.
Well, I think so. I go back to it's the frequency that'll be interesting to watch. If they had Cup, you know, 2 or 3 Cup races in an 8 to 10 day stretch, I think that would be an interesting case study, and we'll have to see how that goes. You know, when the NFL goes to Thursday, you know, Saturday, Sunday, then Monday, not so many Saturdays mixed in, but it's difficult for the football fan to watch that much football, and you've also got high school and colleges mixed in. And I know those are different times. But you're throwing 7 races in 11 days. That may not give us a true reflection of what's out there in terms of appetite. But again, it's a competition. I'm glad we're getting started. I'm glad NASCAR is getting started, and I'll be eager for IndyCar to do the same.
It's actually, I'm sure, fewer television shows with on-track activity than normal. So a normal right. weekend with all 3 series racing and qualifying for all 3 series televised and practices for Cup and some of the Xfinity, you know, you've got 10 shows per weekend. So the NASCAR fan is hardy, and they will settle in and they'll watch a lot of television. And now they don't have, although the weather is getting better, so that will impact things a little bit. And also what struck me is that Fox is going to reap some of the benefits of this because they get started first. They have this portion of the schedule, and they're not going to have any competition. By the time you get a little later on, the newness will have worn out a little bit. Some other sports will, if all goes well, come back on the scene a little bit. But this is going to be a great opportunity for Fox, for especially the weeknight ratings. We all know that there are hazards for the gates for a weeknight race, and that's one of the reasons why they haven't happened. But the gate is not a concern right now. So I am very curious to see what a Wednesday night race will do. Now, they've only named the first four cup events. So Atlanta has been reported, but that's not officially announced at this point. We don't know anything beyond Charlotte. The word is that next week they will announce the rest of the schedule. And they do have a schedule. And obviously this is all TBD and plans can change depending on what's going on with the pandemic. But three tracks, Kurt, are going to lose a race, because they've given Darlington two extra races, two races at Darlington, and that goes along with their Labor Day weekend race. Charlotte is getting an extra race to go along with their Roval race in the fall. So we don't know what that's going to be, but Adam Stern, our guest last week, said that we think it's probably going to be an intermediate, a short track, and a road course. Well, with the environment in California, sounds like Sonoma's in a little bit of trouble at this point. And then two of the other tracks are ISC NASCAR tracks. So the candidates would be Martinsville, Dover, Talladega, Richmond's, Homestead. They've all had races postponed. Kansas is next after Charlotte. That seems unlikely the next week for them to make the trip to Kansas. Michigan the week after that, that seems unlikely. So that category is where you're going to see someone lose a race from at this point. So let's get to Texas Motor Speedway now. Eddie Gossage had hoped that Texas would be on the NASCAR schedule. And while I said June hasn't been confirmed at this point, Eddie did tell WFAA.com that we're not expecting to be on NASCAR's schedule in the near term. And that, by the way, that's one of the ones that's been postponed so far. He did say we expect to make that up at some point. And he has said we are planning on IndyCar coming. So that gives us more of a date. I know the schedule is out there, but all signs are pointing towards IndyCar resuming on June 6th at Texas Motor Speedway.
Yeah, I think more and more my optimism is that we'll see race cars at Texas Motor Speedway on the 6th of June. What I don't know is what else we'll see at Texas on June the 6th. Will we see a limited number of crew members? Will we see a limited number of media? Will we see, obviously, I think it stands to reason we'll see a limited number of fans. Just exactly what the makeup is of those in attendance, I'm sure there are, you know, plans being developed. But at this point, we've not heard. Maybe we can get something from Mark Miles on that subject. But again, my optimism for race cars and racing on that day is pretty high at this point, you know, barring a surprise in the pandemic, which could happen as, you know, as states are starting to open up and, you know, Indiana by next week, we'll have more of the businesses opening. We've already started to see some shopping malls, some of those kind of things starting to allow people in. And so if you extrapolate this 2 weeks, you know, what does 2 weeks from now look like in terms of cases reported? So we're going to have to see. But I am more optimistic than maybe I was a week ago.
I think you're best served to wait as long as you can before you finalize plans. And I think you have the ability to wait until after that May 17th NASCAR race to see how they do it. I think they're talking about the number is maybe 16 crew members are involved, and NASCAR has a typically bigger crew than IndyCar, and they haven't announced what they're planning as far as what media is allowed outside of the television partner and so forth. But I think you can probably wait until maybe right after that date, and that also gives you the 2 or 3 week to make sure that the numbers don't go very much in the wrong direction. And Eddie has said that, you know, we're still holding out just a little bit of hope for fans. It probably seems pretty unlikely at this point, but there is enough room to social distance at Texas. And my guess is if you just went with the tickets already sold, you know, we're talking before March, at the pandemic, that's probably not very many, because I think he does most of his ticket selling here in the, he's always said this, in the few weeks leading up to the race itself. Maybe that's a way that you can get that done. So there's still a chance of that, but I don't think you have to make any decision right now.
Yeah, I think you're right. The more that I think about it, his pre-sale, probably whatever that figure is, and you know, we can argue that number because we don't have that, those numbers available to us, but his pre-sale number probably is a sufficient number of people if you were going to ideally come up with what the crowd should look like and be able to space those apart sufficiently. So, and then, you know, it's pretty confident in saying this. If I had a ticket right now for that June 6th race and I was going to bring my family, I'd have to think about it. You know, I think I'll have made a decision come, you know, in 3 weeks from now. I think I'll feel better, but I might feel worse. So anyway, my point is, yeah, whatever the pre-sale ticket number is, you're going to lose some of those people who are just unwilling to come out in groups at that point.
Adam Stern of Sports Business Journal also reports what we suspected, that IndyCar in Texas are negotiating to reduce the annual sanction fee per sources in order to allow next month's race to go off with little to no fans or hospitality guests. So that seems obvious at this point. On the good news front as well, for those that really want to see a resumption of some activity, I saw a tweet from Road America saying, based on the latest county order, we are now open for camping. Our first weekend is May 8th through 10th, which is this weekend. And after Texas, that's the next race on the calendar. So yeah, that's a big area too. So that's a long ways away in many ways, more than 6 weeks or so at this point. So that could be run with fans. It could be run without fans. It could be run with limited fans. As far as the following date, Richmond, the last weekend in June, the AP reports that the Virginia governor said he anticipates that business restrictions will ease on May 15th. The state is currently under a stay-at-home order until June 10th. But that order can be rescinded earlier. I've seen some of the phases there. It looks like that's a little bit of a gray area for that last weekend in June. Going by the letter of the law, it might be tough to be just fully open, but I think that it seems like there still is a chance for Richmond. What that also tells us is that it's going to be a little while before their cup races from Richmond and Martinsville can be made up. Could that be teamed with IndyCar? Maybe. Maybe that's a consideration as well for the end of June. But if NASCAR already has a schedule in mind, they're probably placing dates and races in June where they know right now they can go race. So my guess would be that Richmond NASCAR is not teamed with IndyCar at the end of June.
Yeah, I would. I started to think that I had a different opinion until you said that, you know, they probably just don't want to be committed to Richmond, committed to any place for that matter, where they're uncertain what the timeline is. I would have thought that would have been a good place. Richmond, you know, has a great relationship. I mean, obviously a NASCAR-owned facility, but, you know, a great relationship with kind of both sides of the fence. And that could be a place where you could see a doubleheader with IndyCar and NASCAR. But I'm with you. It seems unlikely that NASCAR would be sort of committing themselves to being in Richmond the last weekend of June when that seems tentative at best.
I suppose they could decide to move the IndyCar race as well to a later date to combine those activities.
As I said,
though, last week when we were talking about Texas, I'm wondering, though, do you really want more people at a track the same weekend? Is that an obstacle at this point, having NASCAR and all their officials there and then IndyCar and all of their officials at the same time? So it may make sense for the short term just to keep them separate. Now, the July 4th weekend is where they will be together if all goes according to plan. And we got some good news from the state of Indiana that has a chance of happening now.
Yeah, it sounds like green light for Indianapolis in terms of larger events such as this. you know, you've got another facility that's pretty big and an ability to spread out more so than say the Indy 500 could, given ticket sales. Again, not only is it a long time in the calendar before July 4th, I guess, you know, that's two full months. And there's so much, you know, that we can still learn. You know, we're at the point, we're only like 5 or 6 weeks into this. And it seems like it's been, you know, a year. So, you know, fluid is clearly the operative word.
Unfortunately, I each week say, well, we'll know a lot more in about 2 to 3 weeks. I think this is one of those weeks from 4 or 5 days ago that does make more sense because things are opening back up. We'll see what the numbers look like if they significantly go up again, up in the bad way, then you may see a change of plans. But if they stay stable or somehow even go down, then I think it might be full steam ahead and you can start to make some more definitive plans at this point. Mark Miles is going to give us hopefully some more insight on that coming up in just a moment. Also, throughout the month of May, along with having Donald Davidson each Thursday night at 6 o'clock on our show, we'll revisit and talk about some previous Indy 500s. An impromptu Legends of the Speedway segment, Ari Leyendijk, the two-time winner and the fastest man ever at Indianapolis, will be on the show coming up just after 8 o'clock tonight. We will get into iRacing and plenty more, including some of your tweets, too, at KevinLee23, all coming up, Trackside 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
I'm Ryan Hunter-Reay, and this is Trackside with Kurt Cavan and Kevin Lee on 1070 The Fan.
Thanks for staying with us as Trackside continues, 93.5, 107.5 The Fan. Kevin Lee, Kurt Cavan, and the CEO of Penske Entertainment, Mark Miles, has been kind enough to join us here this evening. So I would ask you what's life like these days in quarantine, but I suspect your life and your job has never, ever been busier. Is that correct?
Kevin, that's very insightful. You know, I always thought we were going at full tilt, and now it's just even more crazy. I said to somebody this morning, I feel like the days which start about, in some ways, about 5:30, and end, if they end at 7:30 before Roger and I talk again, they go like that, you know, just Mach 4. And then the, you know, at the same time, it feels like a week is 3 months long. So I don't really know how to explain those two things, but there is not enough time in the day. Everything is jam-packed. The various technology platforms are scheduled call after call after call. In some ways, I think we're more productive because there are just fewer distractions.
Yep.
But it's there's always something that you got to get done, and you want to get it done right away. And there's so many different contingencies to plan for that. I think that's probably a big part of why it seems like there's extra work. You're remaking the deck that you'd already imagined time after time.
Yeah, I suspected that was going to be your issue, is that if you had one goalpost you were chasing or aiming for, that would be one thing. And that's kind of how the day-to-day life is normally. And in this case, it's there have been five different goalposts. And what is the goalpost you're shooting for?
Yeah, it's 5 times 50. You know, it just keeps so many iterations. So what are the goalposts? We want to get back to racing for IndyCar. And I think soon we'll be able to confirm our expectation that we'll be at Texas Motor Speedway in the first week of June. And then, you know, we'll see what's next for IndyCar, but hopefully we can be at Road America. And I've told folks in all candor, we very much hope that we can race in Toronto, but that the Canadian authorities seem more cautious at the moment, or maybe that's not the right word, but a little slower to open up so far than in the States. So I think that's a question. You know, we're just going to take it race by race. We're in touch with the promoters and the authorities to know what's possible, and it changes all the time. And then for IMS, you talk about contingencies. You know, we've got SVRA in June. we're going to do the Brickyard. We believe one way or another, and the two ways are essentially without fans or with. We believe that that July 4th weekend, unless we get a, you know, bad news, a set of negative developments with respect to the COVID analysis from a health perspective, we ought to be able to figure out how to make the Brickyard work with fans. But that's, I mean, so just think about everything you want to think through there, how to do it, the countless variations of each of those things, come to the best conclusions, making sure that we've got the ability to execute, that we've got great input from medical experts and COVID experts and public authorities. So we just keep plugging away and being ready for whatever's possible. And I think we'll know a lot more, obviously, in the next 2, 3, 4 weeks about July.
The governor's five-phase plan in Indiana did coincide with that July 4th weekend. So if all goes well, that will allow for fans. For Texas, is there a plan with fans and without fans right now? Eddie Gossage has made mention that they're still holding out a glimmer of hope that it could include some fans.
Well, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but I think our expectation is we have to be prepared to race without fans. And so that's kind of the mode we're planning in at the moment. I do want to say something about the governor's announcement, since you brought it up, Kevin. Yeah, he talked about how phase five, kind of the other side of the planet at the moment, would start hopefully July 4th, which we thought was a very pleasant coincidence, very hopeful coincidence. But you probably also noted that they've kind of themed their reopening campaign, for lack of the right word, the communications around these phases and everything COVID now is called Back on Track. And so, you know, that's aspirational for all of us. It's not meant to be so much literally true as it is for society and for all of us in the economy and health, but it has a special meaning for race fans too.
Do you I assume you have great empathy for your promoters. NASCAR has a situation where their revenue largely comes from a TV contract. In this case, in IndyCar's case, much of the promoter's revenue comes from having people at the race. And so you must have great empathy for what they must go through as well.
We do. I think we and Roger Penske we want to race, and we need to be sensible, and we need to be supportive. And if we can, we want to make arrangements, maybe revised arrangements, so that it all makes sense for the stakeholders. So yeah, we're not operating in some sort of cookie cutter mode where we're oblivious to realities.
How is the TV partner involved in this, especially in the early going? We're talking made for TV events. What kind of discussions or arrangements have you made with NBC Sports?
Well, first of all, it goes back to their strong support for our iRacing, which we were really thrilled about. I think it was a great kind of placeholder over the last, five weekends of NBCSN coverage of that competition. And it turned out to be fun and exciting, and I think great for our drivers, and kept a lot of fans, at least with a taste of IndyCar. Beyond that, it's a hugely important thing, and NBC could not be better to work with at this point. You know, the way I think about it is, imagine a table and all of their properties that they got to broadcast over the course of a year being spaced throughout the year, and all of a sudden somebody tilted the table and all the properties fell to the same end, and they've got to figure out how to take all this programming and really get it into a crowded, shortened part of the year. Huge challenge. And even today I was talking with one of their senior people. They're not really sure about various events that they're committed to covering, not just in the States, by the way, right? So, you know, they got Premier League and other things from Europe. So, man, you talk about complexity. That there, it's a real challenge to sequence decisions so that you can get through what you need to decide when you need to decide it, but you haven't gotten yourself too far forward, so you cause an unintended problem later. But for us, in all the scenarios we have for IndyCar coverage, there is the kind of television coverage that we would expect in a normal year. In fact, in some ways, in a shorter period of weeks for the season, we may end up with relatively more on network, on NBC, than on cable, because it's many of the cable races that we missed at the beginning of the year. So it could be really a little bit shorter, but potent coverage as well.
Do you have, I mean, your goal is to get as many as possible here on out, but do you have a target number that you feel like you need to get to?
You know, I think that depends on who you talk to. Some of the teams have said to us, gee, we'd really like to make sure we get at least 12, but there's just no ironclad number. Everybody's going to have to work through whatever it is with their people, employees, drivers, sponsors, and all the commercial interests, whatever it is. So, yeah, I think it's 12 to 15. Right now it's 15. We do think we have some flexibility in replacing events if additional events just can't be staged. Doubleheaders come to mind as a way you could imagine making up for an event that doesn't happen if that occurs again. It's pretty efficient. Everybody's planning to be there anyway. A promoter's planning to promote. You add a day. It generally is a positive thing for a promoter and a pretty efficient thing for us as a broadcast partner and for the teams. So we'll see. We think we can hang in there, and unless we all get really bad news about the future course of infections and the healthcare impacts, we think we can have a pretty good season.
Mark Miles, the CEO of Penske Entertainment, is joining us. There may be a NASCAR track or two or three that loses one of their dates, and in one case, maybe their only date for the season. Is there any scenario where you would consider a venue that wasn't on the schedule to replace something that wasn't on the current schedule this year, but it's a track that you've raced at before?
Yeah, that is not something that's in our thinking right now. I just think to start from scratch, if NASCAR didn't go there, there was probably a reason, you know, because they're trying to get as many events as possible. It probably would have to do with uncertainty around the health environment. Mm-hmm. And so to wade into that when we might have other alternatives probably doesn't seem like the first way for us to go.
You've got, I think about Indianapolis, and I know there's so much water to still go under the bridge, but you've got it's not like you can separate people at the Indy 500. You're going to have, you know, shoulder to shoulder people. Is it all or nothing in terms of fans?
That's a really good question. And I would say, I don't think so at this point. So there's two scenarios, right? All or nothing in terms of fans, but I wouldn't completely reject the idea that we could come up with ways to provide for some distancing if that's essential. We want to run the 500, however we got to do it. And yeah, we can't run the 500 we know the way, in a way that would provide for a lot of social distancing. But one, maybe that won't be required by late August, or two, maybe there is a way to work with our fans and provide the possibility of some spacing. So I'm not going to elaborate on that, and I'm not suggesting we don't have a favorite scenario. Our favorite scenario is to be able to get everybody in and have a race as close to normal as possible. But we are thinking about every way we could imagine making sure we can stage the race.
I don't know if the climate or the situation would be any different in October, but would it potentially be considered, if it looks like you could have everyone in the facility on that October road course date that was added, could that possibly be an option explored this summer for the 500?
Yeah, whether it was that weekend or another weekend, one of the things that, you know, if we got 10 fans together and we said, let's make a list of 10 things we ought to imagine as possibilities, one of them would, if you can't do it at the end of August, would be do it later.
Okay.
So I'm not going to focus on a particular week, but certainly that's something you'd have to consider if it was advisable at the time, that we have to make the call.
From an IMS standpoint, have you been able to take on, does the workforce allow you to take on some extra projects that maybe you didn't think you'd get done for 2020 Indy 500 in May and maybe get started, or you just not have the workforce?
Well, Kurt, if your question is particularly about the facilities.
The facility.
I think it has been an opportunity, and Roger Penske has doubled down on it. You know, he's coming in on Saturdays. He's very careful. We're doing everything we can do to ensure that everybody stays healthy, but we cover a lot of ground. One Saturday morning, my phone said we walked 5.5 miles, and I can't tell you how many, this is like in the last month. I can't tell you how many restrooms we were in, how many square yards of paving we looked at, new graphics for video boards, and really everything. So that work continues. What we did when the governor first put out his executive order, we weren't certain what it might mean for us. So we asked more than 50 contractors to pause, and they did, and they were terrific about it. But it was clear to us 10 days later, and in consultation with the governor's office and others, that construction was okay. And so we started bringing them back, and that place is a anthill right now. It is there's a lot of work being done. It's just going to look terrific.
Final thing I think for me is, along those lines, what about the other business you would normally be dealing with at this point as the season goes along? Have you had to put that on the back burner, things such as searching for a third engine partner, exploring potential new venues for future schedules, the next generation car that's maybe more Jay Fry's department than yours? What has the other business been like during this period?
I think that's another really insightful question. I mean, this is not the time to find the third OEM, right? Yeah. I mean, just think about the industry and what everybody's going through. And there are other examples like that you mentioned, we want to stabilize this calendar and in time get to next year's calendar. And once we got a sense of what normal looks like again. But we're just focused on nailing everything we can execute well for this year. And one thing that we've learned about ourselves as an organization, I think, and it's very much inspired by Roger and his leadership, is how much you can get done in a very little amount of time. And so there'll be time to, you know, to move to the things that we're kind of pushing out for now. And right now we're trying to use our time to make sure we can make the most for 2020.
I lied. I do have one more question about, assuming things are back on track at Texas the first week of June, do you already have a logistical plan, safety precautions, or can you watch what happens with NASCAR and learn a little bit what works and maybe what needs to be tweaked from them? Is what kind of advantage does that provide that you go a couple of weeks later than them?
Yeah, well, I think we have the best of both worlds. We have a very detailed plan that is very well thought through. It's done in consultation or collaboration with the people at Texas Motor Speedway, and other COVID authorities around the country have given us input. And so we know what we expect we want to do. If we learn something from NASCAR's forays first into getting back without fans, then certainly we can tweak what we're planning on doing. One of the things that we realize that is a tremendous opportunity for us is Tim Bachman. So you all know him. Some of your listeners will know he's a former deputy chief of the Indianapolis Fire Department, who's a long-serving member of the IndyCar safety crews. And now, after retiring from IFD, became the head of our track safety operations. Well, as deputy chief of the Indianapolis Fire Department, at one time or another in his career, he was responsible for planning all kinds of countywide EMS, fire, and coordinated plans for reactions to, you know, natural disasters and catastrophes. So this is a guy with a career of experience to deal with just this kind of thing. And he's terrific at getting the right intelligence, the right expertise brought to bear. And he's just a great team member with either the IMS personnel or the IndyCar personnel who are trying to make good judgments about how to implement plans. And he's doing that now for both IndyCar and IMS and IMS Productions. So we're really lucky to have Tim in that role. And in the course of about 2 weeks, he's already added an enormous expertise and value.
I'm feeling better than I did a week or two ago. I think we can start to see a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. So hopefully a life resumes to some normalcy here. We know it won't be for a little while, but we'll get back at least at a racetrack sometime safely in the future. Mark, thank you for your time. We'll see you soon.
All right. You guys take care of yourselves. All the best to your listeners as well.
Thank you. Mark Miles, the CEO of Penske Entertainment. Ari Leyendijk is still to come. Stay with us. Plenty more. Trackside 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
I'm Tony Kanaan, and this is Trackside with Kurt Covin and Kevin Lee on 1070, The Fan.
Our first installment of Legends of the Speedway with Ari Leyendijk is coming up in just a few minutes. Let's touch on in this segment kind of what we learned from Mark Miles. There's a lot to unpack there, and I think a lot of good information.
Yeah, I think I'll be listening to it another time after the show's over just to make sure that I heard what I thought I heard. A few things I heard. For certain, he's full steam ahead on Texas and Road America as the first two races for this abbreviated season. He has a good solid plan, or they do, for running the Texas race. I heard that Toronto seems like a challenge because it's a street race and a lot to build out. I heard that he's full steam ahead for the July 4th weekend, barring some interesting things happening. I heard that there are options for the rest of the season. Maybe that's double headers that he wants to still to try to get to at least 12 races, maybe as many as 15. I heard that you could run the Indy 500 in October. And, you know, there's a lot to unpack. I also heard a good question that you ask is his focus and their focus is on 2020 only. And at this point, they're not concerning themselves with issues related to building out 2021.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see any kind of schedule announcement for 21 for a little while. We need to get the 20 schedule finished at this point. In fact, today I just saw Jim Utter post something on the NASCAR scene that they were hoping for April. And next year's NASCAR schedule is likely to be very, very different. I'm not sure that IndyCar's is going to be that different. You know, hope is that it's very similar, but you may see some tracks go away. You may see some really creative things. And now the best guess is we're looking at July, because I think you have to see what happens this year before anything can happen and get confirmed for 21 as far as that's concerned. And for the Indianapolis 500, I'll read an email from Dale in Dayton, Ohio. If social distancing is still required in August, maybe spectators at the 500 is not an all or nothing proposition. He sent this in before Mark's interview. Maybe the Speedway could allow a limited number of fans in, for example, the top 10% of ticket holders by seniority, or maybe the top 10% in each grandstand. If time allows, they could reissue tickets for the new date to only the allowed ticket holders and probably at a premium for less crowd, less traffic, etc. The scalper market would get crazy, but I've gone to every race since 74 with my friend who has had tickets continuously since and hope to continue this year. And then a tweet, I was trying to find the original tweet from a couple of weeks ago, but I think it may have been from AJ Hahn, who tweeted me again today, and you as well, and said they need to hurry up and make a decision so we can order our tickets. And he, or I apologize if it wasn't someone else, basically said, if they only allow limited tickets in, I'm going to be very, very angry. You can't do that. It's all or nothing. That's kind of an idea. First of what he said today, well, you can't make a decision right now because unfortunately it's on the schedule. So a decision has been made, but you can't guarantee the race is going to happen with full fans because society and the government will not allow that. So there's nothing that can be done. But to his point about being angry, it's going to be a very delicate situation if you do have a scenario where not everyone can attend and how you adjudicate that.
Well, and think about this. You've got a deadline of which you need to make a decision on that front. Because if you know, it's one thing if you tell all the fans who have tickets, sorry, you can't come. That's one thing. But if you've got to tell fans that a certain percentage can come, well, you got to make some quick work. The ticket office is going to be pretty busy pretty quickly.
Have you come up with any better idea than what I threw out there last week, that you essentially have to refund everyone and start selling again, probably at an inflated prices?
I don't think they'll do it at inflated prices. When you talked about the scalper market, I just don't think Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Penske Corporation are going to inflate tickets to that point. I think they'll have some other kind of system where either it's random or, I mean, and I don't know. There's still a lottery, like they would do for the
Final Four here in Indianapolis at times. There have been a lottery for that before.
Yeah, I mean,
that's the circumstance.
I just don't think they'll inflate the prices. Now, the scalper market indeed would be high, but yeah. I don't think the Speedway's practice would be to say double the ticket prices. I don't see them doing that. That's not in their DNA.
Yeah, they may not. The NFL will. I guarantee you the NFL is going to treat all of the tickets available as premium suite experiences in your bleacher seat in the upper deck, socially distanced or something like that. So that's a conversation that is going to have to be continued. We'll get to more of your tweets coming up in the next hour. We've still got some time to chat. And we reminisce with Ari Leyendyke coming up next. Trackside 93.5, 107.5 The Fan.
This is Joseph Newgarden, and you're listening to Trackside with Kurt Cavan and Kevin Lee on 1070 The Fan.
Thanks for staying with us. It's hour number two of Trackside, 93.5, 107.5 The Fan. Brad Huber is in our studios in Indianapolis. Kevin Lee is in the Avon location. Kurt Cavan is in parts there about in the Indianapolis area. And this is a new feature in the program that we just kind of came up with this afternoon because it's the month of May and we unfortunately don't have racing. So let's do Legends of the Speedway in May. And we welcome the 1990-1997 winner, the 85 Rookie of the Year, Ari Leyendyke. Ari, how are you? How are you maintaining during the quarantine?
I'm good, thanks. And I'm glad to hear it. Looks like you guys are all doing fine. But unfortunately, no racing. And it's boring as hell, of course, for all of us. And we can't wait to get back with it.
Any pulling out of old videos? You watch 90 or 97? When was the last time you sat down and watched one of those two races?
I think it was last summer when I was here by myself and Mika was on vacation in Holland. And I got bored and I went on YouTube and I found pretty much everything I wanted to find. And then watching some of the old races, I went back to races like in Detroit and Cleveland and Meadowlands. And I go like, oh, I forgot about that. But then it all came back. So it's pretty cool. You can go back to YouTube and find pretty much any race that you've ever been in.
Well, let's go back to 1990 and start with that 500 win. You had been running in kart for a few years. You'd finished on the podium a few times, including a couple of times on road courses. I know your wins were on ovals, but you almost won at Portland a couple of times. But your first IndyCar win is the Indianapolis 500. What kind of expectations did you have coming into that month of May?
Coming into the month of May, we were excited that we were arriving there with the Ilmor engine, because we knew that in order to win Indy, you had to have a Chevy Ilmor. So after the first couple of days of practice, we were really getting quietly confident and excited because the car was handling really good. And we were basically fine-tuning the car the rest of the week leading up to qualifying. And then, of course, we were able to qualify or not able to qualify on the first weekend, which was a bummer because we had to kind of wait until the next weekend to qualify, but also get ready for the race with the race setup. So we used the backup car for the race setup. And the other car we kept working on, tweaking a little bit for qualifying. But that whole month went really smooth. And you couldn't have asked for a better month preparation-wise. We never had any issues. So yeah, I was on race morning. I was really confident that we could do well because the car had been so good on full tank runs and on race setup runs. So I had quite a bit of confidence going into the race, despite the fact that I never won a race. But
it occurred to me that that you and Emerson had won 89 and 90, and that was pretty rare to have a couple non-American drivers win the 500. And then since then, I mean, it's really kind of become commonplace.
Yeah, it is. I think that I was the first European to win the 500 since Graham Hill, which was 1966. So that had been a long while. And now it's just common that a non-American wins the race, especially the last 10 years. So.
Go ahead, Art.
Go ahead. No, it was. I know Damon Hill, and I got a note from the Hill family. So that was pretty neat, actually, that they also remembered that fact that their dad, their husband, was the last European to win the 500. So I got a little note from them congratulating me. So that was cool.
As with any 500-mile race, there are different contenders at different points. Second half of the race, you were always in it, but you took the lead, I think, for good on lap 168 on Ray Hall. And I read that you were so consumed with that battle late in the race that you did not notice the white flag. Is that true?
No, it was a little bit different, the story. I had passed Ray Hall for the lead, and my car was really good. But I also started to develop blistering. And I slowed down, and I was afraid that he might catch me, but his handling went off the last part of the race too, so I was okay. But we didn't have the big blistering problems like Emerson had and like Alonso Jr. had, because it cost them a lap. They had to make an extra pit stop. We didn't. We were able to finish our stint on the blistered tires, but they were, you know, small blisters, but they were definitely there. So it was something that most teams were battling that day. But no, Emerson was then, because of his lap down, he came to unlap himself right at the white flag. So I was looking in my mirror at him and paying attention to what he was doing. And then I just let him by. But when that was going on down the front straight, I didn't see the white flag. So, you know, you kind of lose track of time. And so I came around and saw the check, and I go, oh, there's the check. You know, I missed the white flag. But that really helped me. Sorry, but that really helped me later in 97, because in 97, I said to myself, I want to see that white flag. I want to see the flag, because, you know, and then when I was really paying attention to the starter stand, I see not only the white flag, but I see, to my surprise, the green flag. And I'm like, that's when I came on the radio and I go like, what the F is going on?
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going to go, because you ended up with a one lap shootout, so to speak, for the 97 win, and it wasn't contested particularly because you got a good jump, and you essentially, the experience you had before prepared you for that moment.
Well, it didn't prepare me, because I was expecting to just follow the just ride around and finish on the yellow, because the lights had not gone out on the pace car, but the pace car did go into the pits. So I was not ready for it, because I was in the wrong gear. I had just went up a gear to kind of cruise around, and then all of a sudden I had to go down a gear. So I really thought I'm going to be passed left and right by everybody, but luckily it was a surprise to everybody.
All right, Lion Dyke is joining us, two-time Indianapolis 500 winner, three-time pole sitter, held the fastest race record average until 2013, and the fastest man ever at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. No matter what circumstances you win the 500, it's all the same. However, what kind of extra pride is involved that in that 90 win, you beat everybody? All of the legends were in that race. I think 11 either had already won or would win the race. What does that mean to you?
Well, of course, you know, back then and now to win the 500 is just amazing. And you don't really think about, you know, who did I beat or this and that. But then you look back at it, you know, a couple of years later and you go like, oh, it's pretty cool. You know, Mears kind of had a bad day Voigt was there, and everybody was there. Emerson, of course, and I think John Cock was in the race, even still, Sneba, you name it, a bunch of guys that had achieved so much. So, yeah, that really made it even better. But I always say my 97 win was felt as good, because it actually was, it was harder for me to win that race than it was the 1990 race, just based on the fact that the new IRL cars were pretty tricky to drive, and they were not as comfortable as the 90 car.
Let's back up to the first time that you saw the Speedway and the first time you raced there. You, if I remember right, you had run a couple road courses, or I think Elkhart Lake and Long Beach, before you got to Indy, but in kart, but you had not raced on an oval until 85. Is that the first time you had seen the track? And is that the first, I mean, obviously the first time that you had raced on such a track?
I had, in 84, I drove my first IndyCar race at Elkhart Lake. And I don't remember if it was before or after. I believe it was after. Yeah, it was after, because it was pretty cold. We did a 200 lap simulated race, just me by myself with the team, and we did pit stops and everything. So that was my only experience on an oval in an Indy car before we got to Indy. And of course, the rookie orientation that we had at Indy was really helpful. And I just gradually built up the speed. And back then you had the cross ply tires, and those were pretty iffy. You know, one set would be great, and then you put another set on and the car got loose, or the car got a lot of push. And we had a pretty inexperienced crew as well. So I just really took to it slowly, because I was afraid to crash, because I had seen a bunch of crashes and I didn't like what I saw. It's like never a small crash. And so I was pretty nervous about that. But yeah, so I came in really with little experience, but as the race wore on, I started really getting into a rhythm. And I actually, at one point, it's, you know, when you do all these interviews, you're kind of repeating yourself, but the thought came through in my mind, like, I really like this, you know. And I always, when I coach guys, I say, you know, you need to find the coolness factor in it, that you, and you need to like it. And when you like it, you're going to be good at it. And I think that's what I had.
Definitely, you were good at it, and that became a forte. And there are a lot of guys like that that came from European road racing and became oval masters. Is that the biggest key, is just taking a liking to it? And is it a mental thing more than anything else?
It's definitely a mental thing, because if your car doesn't handle well and you just not sure what it's going to do in the middle of the corner, it feels loose and it feels unstable. I mean, it's almost like terrifying, but once you have it all together, it can feel so good, and you can feel so confident in the car because you know the car can do it. And then you even extract more out of it. Like, you know, you take a little bit more wing out for qualifying and you trim it out more and you just tweak it because the basic handling is so good and gives you a lot of confidence. But I've always said that I've never liked slow corners. Like the Long Beach hairpin was one of my worst experiences in racing, because it's not really a racing corner down in first gear to me. But I never really liked the ultra slow corners. But I always loved fast corners where you were in either, you know, one gear down from top gear, that being fourth or fifth. I've always enjoyed the fast corners, even when I was younger, driving Formula Fords and Formula 3. So I guess fast corners is something I always liked, and that helped me on the ovals.
Like I guess all of us, it has to seem weird that you're not packing a bag to come to Indianapolis. You've been coming to Indianapolis in the month of May for what must feel like half your life. This is weird.
Yeah, it is very weird. And yeah, the first time I went to Indy was 1984 as a guest of Provimi. They had Derek Daly drive and Tony Bettenhausen. And so that was my first experience at Indy. And the first time I actually was at Indy was in 81, when I drove Super V and Meek and I went around Indianapolis in the tour bus. And the first thing I thought was like, man, this place is narrow. You know, it looks so big on TV, but then once you're on the front straight, it's not that wide. So that was my first experience. But yeah, it definitely feels weird. It just feels so strange. And I'm just hoping that we can race in August, because we still want to be at Indy this year.
Ari Leyendijk, the two-time 500 winner, is joining us. Let's go back to 96 and the four-lap record, pushing almost 238 miles per hour. And then you mentioned 97, of how difficult that can be. I think we talked about this 10 or 15 years ago. Easier in a car that was good going 237 plus than a car that doesn't feel so good at 217, 218?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, that it was definitely the case. I mean, at Indianapolis, if your car goes off, if the handling goes off and you have a, because of tires or whatever, tires wearing out, or the tire has a big stagger, and you could slow down to around 200 miles an hour and even below that and scare the heck out of yourself, you know, when the car is that unpredictable. So it is obviously important to have a good handling car. In 96, the 237 laps felt a lot better than the 218 laps in 97. So the 97 car was, the engine was quite heavy, the gearbox was quite heavy, and the back end always felt unstable. But Tim Wardrop, my engineer, put a lot of thought into it and made it work. But it wasn't easy to drive that car, for sure. But the 96 car was actually, for me, it was easy. I mean, for me, we got disqualified on Saturday because our backup car had to be put together hastily. They didn't weigh it. We got disqualified from qualifying second because it was 7 pounds underweight. And but that backup car was just not ready and not set up the same as the primary car. But anyhow, we got disqualified, had to qualify on Sunday. And the car was so good in practice in the morning that in qualifying, I was playing around with a bunch of different lines, and it shows on my speeds, because as I kept making changes to my lines, I was picking up a bit of speed. So it was just a fun ride, and there were just no issues. I never had a moment with that car ever the whole month of May.
You stepped away, I think, after 99, wasn't it? And then you came back and ran the 500 a couple, three times. So was that a different type of experience for you?
Yeah, looking back, it was the wrong thing to do, because you have to really, I think, leaving and then coming back and then just running Indy, and then the next year you run Indy, and that's all you do. There's no rhythm there. There's no cohesiveness with the team, really. So it was not the right thing to do. But and I got really lucky when I came back. I think 2001, at one point in practice, I had just put down the quickest lap of the day, so it wasn't going bad in that regard. And then my crew chief said, oh, give me another one like that. And Casey Mears spun out in turn one just ahead of me. And you arrive in one and there's a car just bouncing off the wall coming out of one. And you let off the throttle a bit too much and you try to go down to where you want to avoid stuff. But that made me spin around, and I spun around like three or four times and not knowing what I was going to hit. And then I just came to a stop and the car was pointing straight and I didn't hit anything. So yeah. You have to have a little luck there, but that certainly made me think of why am I here?
Yeah, exactly. And soon you decided I've had enough, and that makes sense. You always have to know when to call it a day. How do drivers,
I think
what's,
it's really
what's the
hard.
Sign they're looking for when they know it's time to stop?
I think when you're dicing and going into a turn, and you know, years prior you would not let off the throttle and go for it, and now you're letting go of the throttle because you're like a little tricky, then you know it's time to stop. And so I definitely had that, and I didn't have that aggressiveness that you need to get the most out of it. So but I crashed in 2003. I crashed pretty heavy the day before qualifying. So after that, I got in the car for two laps on Saturday, but I was really hurting. And I got out, and then I slept for 3 days, and that was a sign of head injury, concussion, and Dr. Bach recommended, and I totally agree with it, not to run. So that's when the team, Monon Racing, put, man, I can't come up with his name right now. California guy, really good.
It's good trivia. Like,
yeah, I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah, I'm drawing a blank.
I was going to ask you, you're in your role as a steward. I mean, obviously people know it from an officiating standpoint, but I see you more as a counselor with these drivers and the young drivers particularly, and particularly in May. You spend a lot of time just kind of listening to them and offering advice, and I see you and Mears kind of doing the same thing with a lot of drivers. I would assume that you find you get great gratification from that.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was coaching some drivers in the past, like Charlie Kimball, Alex Lloyd, several others, Ryan Briscoe, I enjoyed it when they actually listened, and then they would go out and they actually, Mike Conway, for instance, was always going into turn one, turning in just too soon. And he kept on doing it, and it was becoming a habit. So I got on the radio with him. I said, hey, Mike, do you want me to remind you every lap that you're turning in early, or do you want me to remind you every other lap? And he kind of laughed, but it did something, and he got it right away after that. He finally started turning in later where he should have. And that gives me really great satisfaction to see that response, and then also picking up speed and actually being competitive. It's almost as gratifying as being successful yourself. So I can see where Michael Andretti and guys that own teams that used to drive, like Brian Herta, that they get a great deal of satisfaction out of being in that role as well. But as far as being a steward, that's actually, you hit the nail on the head. Max Pappas and I, we talk to the rookies a lot at every race, but especially at Indy, we try to give them a little bit more attention. But we also talk to the veterans, like some guys that they'll do something in practice that is actually a violation. They would get a penalty for it, and we have it on video. And then I'll go to that guy and go like, see, you did this today, but if you run over that line there, it's going to be a penalty. So watch out tomorrow, because I don't really want to see you in the trailer. We're not there to penalize them. We're there to help them, really, more than penalizing them. But obviously, sometimes we have to penalize them because they do something they're not supposed to.
By the way, I looked it up. Alex Barron is who we're talking about.
Yeah, there you go.
Yep.
Yeah, he's good.
Finished sixth that year in the Meyer car. Speaking of rookies, you've got a good relationship with one of the rookies that we hope to see very soon, 19-year-old Rinus Vicky from the Netherlands. Tell me about how you first met him and what the relationship has been like over the last few years.
The relationship has been really good, but I go way back with his dad. His dad, I've known his dad since the mid-90s, and his mechanic used to be a mechanic of mine in the 70s. So my dad also worked on Marijn's Formula Ford car, so that was pretty cool. So we go way back as far as knowing each other, but I did not know Rinus. I only met Rinus when he came here to start racing in the F2000. And I knew he was good in karting. And if you listen to his dad, Marijn, then, you know, Marijn is so proud of his son, just typical dad. So you take that with a grain of salt and you go like, okay, well, I'll wait and see what he's like. And then after the first couple of races and the weekend of Elkhart Lake, when he drove in the F2000 and he won both those races, and the way how he won those races, That was an eye opener to me, and that's when I saw the potential that he has.
What kind of potential does he have at this top level as a 19 and 20 year old?
Well, I think if you look at his career and the way he adapted to all the cars that he jumped into, Pro Mazda, the Indy Lights, and even the first time just getting in an Indy car, being right on pace last year at Portland. I wasn't there, but I got all the feedback also from Ed Carpenter, and it was just very impressive. I think he'll do really well. I think I'm really expecting a lot of good things from him, and I think he's in the perfect team with Ed Carpenter. I think that's a team that can nurture him, give him the opportunity to develop. And of course, Ed is, you know, it's such a shame that we're not starting the month of May now, because I think Ed and his team are so good there. They would have been a great asset and a help to Rinus being a rookie there.
I think since we're on a Zoom call, I can see you. The radio listeners can't see. I think Mika walked by in the background. What are you doing? Yeah. What are you doing with kind of your spare time over the last month? I know you're not a golfer. No. What kind of things have you been doing?
A lot of nothing, because you have in your mind, you say like, oh, and now I can go do this, I'll do this, I'll do that, and then that doesn't happen. I've heard that from a lot of people that said, oh, I'm going to clean up my garage, I'm going to do this, and then it doesn't happen. But we live in a condo in Old Town Scottsdale, and we don't have our own garage, and we don't have a lot to do when it comes to that. So we go on a lot of walks, but that gets older, and biking, and we do see our kids a lot. So they all live close by, so we do see them enough. And the first couple of weeks, Mika came back from the Netherlands in the middle of March, and we stayed home for almost 2 weeks and hardly saw anybody, just because we were checking her temperature all the time. And after that, we relaxed it a little bit. So we do a lot of outdoor stuff.
Speaking of the kids, one of them drove in the Indy 500. And when I Googled Ari Leyendijk to just double check a couple of stats today, it's Ari Jr. who comes up first now. Is that a point of contention? Who's the most famous Ari Leyendijk right now?
I think he is. Yeah, with him being on The Bachelorette and him being on The Bachelor, and then, you know, the social media, what do they call them? Influencers.
Yep.
Ari Jr. and his wife, Lauren, they are just that. It's a whole new world. But, you know, obviously he's enjoying, he doesn't race much anymore, every now and then with Robbie Gordon's stadium trucks. But other than that, he's just being a really good dad.
Good for him. Good for him.
Well, you're the influencer to the two of us. So don't.
That's right.
Let's not forget our priorities.
Yeah, well, there's this generational thing going on. And, you know, we're from a different generation, I guess.
Out of duty, as Ari Jr. was a former broadcast partner of mine, I watched The Bachelor that year. So he still owes me on that one. That's the only time, and it will never happen again. And I think I actually bailed after a few. But I gave it a try just to support my guy.
Yeah,
it's good to catch up with you, Ari.
Yeah, no, it's great. And it's too bad we can't see each other down there in Gasoline Alley instead of like this. But, you know, I think I've heard that Roger Penske has gone through with all the improvements at the Speedway. So when we do go back, it's going to be upgraded. And I really think he's going to be great for IndyCar. And I really feel bad for him that this happened, you know, right as he just purchased the Speedway in the IndyCar series, that now there's nothing going on. So, but it is what it is. And it's like soccer came to a halt, F1 came to a halt, basketball, baseball, everything came to a halt. So everybody's struggling when it comes to that.
The only thing that continues, unfortunately, podcasts. But we are glad you are with us to join us,
yeah,
and help us remember some better times, and we'll have better times again soon. Ari Leyendijk, the two-time winner of the world's greatest race, kind enough to join us on our first official episode of Legends of the Speedway. Thanks, Ari. We'll see you at the racetrack soon.
All right. Thanks, guys. See you soon, I hope.
Stay with us. Plenty more to come. Trackside 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
This is Will Power, and you're listening to Trackside with Kurt Cavan and Kevin Lee on 1070 The Fan.
Good show tonight. Nothing to do with us. It's always good to have Ari Leyendijk and Mark Miles, the CEO of Penske Entertainment, give us some answers and a little bit more intel about what's to come in the near future. So we'll kind of run through rapid fire, and maybe this is for the best as we get to our iRacing segment. It might have been enough. It had come and served its purpose, and maybe it's time to move on because everyone's angry at everyone else. Do any of these feelings carry over? Does what's been displayed in iRacing have any meaningful impact moving forward?
I say absolutely, because you know, clearly some people are ticked off at each other. You know, they were mad at Oliver Askew a couple weeks ago. And then you've got, you know, some Ferrucci, some Askew in there. You know, you've got other guys, you know, it's bound to carry over a little bit. I mean, I'm not saying it carries over to the racetrack, but, you know, it might carry over to Gasoline Alley or, you know, how they work together if they're on a promotional visit later in the season or in a few weeks, or the first driver's meeting could be interesting. So
I think how easily you let someone by when you're a lap down, when it's middle of the race.
Absolutely. You know, we all are pretty sensitive and they're all pretty competitive. And I think it stands to reason that there'll be some side effects, even if we don't see them as people who are following the sport. You know, certainly Lando Norris is going to be a little ticked off and may not feel as excited about IndyCar as he did a week ago. But, you know, ultimately this won't have a lasting, these won't be lasting issues, but certainly in the next, you know, few times we see people and people are together, people are going to remember this.
You know, the Oliver Askew crash at Michigan, I don't think has much of a long-term impact.
No, I agree.
He made a mistake and he was chastised for it. And it was said that, well, this can be a learning experience for a young driver. But, you know, Santino Ferrucci is probably the most polarizing in that circumstance. And there's a group of fans that feel like we have all taken it too easy on Santino, and right or wrong, even if it is just a video game, it did not help his cause to throw himself back into a controversial nature. I know it's a game, but he was crashing intentionally. No, I don't think so, but he was trying to play somebody dirty and hit them and impede their progress to win the race. And that doesn't go over very well.
And it'll be interesting, you know, Simon Pagenaud has been pretty Teflon the last, you know, calendar year since winning the Indy 500. People have really embraced him, and he's been a great champion. Again, I don't think this has a long-lasting situation for him, but some people will not let that go too easily.
In Europe, they won't let it go. And there are apparently death threats, which is unconscionable, but unfortunately is what social media, for some people, a very small minority, is. It's people hiding behind fake names that hurl insults at kickers for college football teams that are 19 years old, the Mystic Kick, and things that make no common sense, but there is no common sense in some regards of social media. But they're serious about it. And the F1 people, they want him to be sanctioned. You know, here's my take on Simon. I do believe that he did something he shouldn't have done. He was trying to be in the way. And I think what he assumed is, I'll lift a little bit here and he'll go around me and he'll lose a little bit of momentum and he'll lose the race. He didn't expect him to just simply run into the back of him. I don't think he was trying to crash him, even though he joked about that, but it got away from him. It got away from him there and he made a mistake. And there's a reason why you haven't heard from Simon. I had a suggestion, maybe I'll look up the tweet and just kind of respond to that, of getting Simon and Lando Norris on the show. I think Lando has had plenty to say about it. But if I'm advising Simon right now, he has said what his perspective was and what happened from his standpoint. I didn't mean to crash him. I only meant to slow him down, and I'm sorry for it. It would be best for him right now to simply not say any more about this, and it would go away a little sooner. Doesn't do him good to keep this in the news cycle.
Yeah, so there clearly has been some ramifications, and you're right that I think based on what we heard Roger Penske say on the Dale Jr. podcast a few weeks ago, and then just feeling like the six races is probably it's served its purpose. And I wouldn't be surprised if we've seen the last of the races, not only from IndyCar, but from other sports as well.
Now, I hope that doesn't end this, because I do think it serves a good purpose. And for limited expenses, these events received good ratings. Again, over 900,000 for the NASCAR event. It was 160,000 or 50,000 or something like that on cable TV this past Saturday for the IndyCar event. So I do still see a potential scenario for a short off-season series. Maybe it's only one is televised and the other are on YouTube, but I think it can serve a purpose to see the personality. But boy, we have seen several examples, though, that everyone needs to understand that enough people take this seriously that if you're going to be involved, you should take it seriously as well, because there are major repercussions.
Yeah, I did disagree with the with those that said, well, it's just a video game. You know, the amount of time, because Lando Norris summed this up pretty well, that they he spent a lot of time, and all these drivers took a lot of family time away to practice and to really put on a good show. So it was not just a video game. I mean, people used a significant amount of time, money, mental energy to put on a good show for others, and not to mention the TV folk and the behind-the-scenes people that it takes to make this happen. So it's not just a video. A video game would have been what you and I would play in my living room on my television, and no one else was involved. There were a lot of people involved. So it isn't just a video game, while I understand their point.
I'm happy for Tony Kanaan, because he has approached it like a profession. He tried to learn how to do this, spent hours and hours, and either a technical glitch or getting crashed, and he never really got a chance to show what he can do. So he's in that camp that's, I've had it, I'm done with it. Let's just simply wait and get back to the real thing. Now, that said, I'm sure there will still be events organized, just not on television, but you can follow Twitch, and I'm sure some will be on YouTube and some different categories there. Andrew Rowlandson is who sent the tweet. The Real Wilba said, this week is the most pumped I've ever been for Trackside. You should book Lando and Simon. So apologies, we didn't do that. I don't have Lando's number. And again, I think Simon should probably move on from this at this point. So we fortunately have some real world things that we needed to cover in the show this week, including when will we get back and what needs to happen for us to get back to seeing actual races. So we'll get to some more of your tweets and see what we missed. And there's quite a bit that we've missed. We'll cover what we can in just a moment. Trackside 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
This is Eli Castroneves. You are listening to Trackside with Kirk Kevin and Kevin Lee on 1070 The Fan.
Thanks for staying with us. Trackside continues. So made it clear on Twitter tonight that it's been best to tape the interviews. So I've had a chance to multitask and do some other things while the show has been going on. And I hope you enjoy the conversations with Ari Lyndyke. Always great to catch up with Ari and a couple of things we'd forgotten about and maybe didn't know. And I think some really good information with Mark Miles about what IndyCar is thinking and some of their ideas. So if you missed that, I suggest you go back and find the podcast. It'll be posted here in about 10 minutes or so at 1075thefan.com or on iTunes and the usual locations, and you'll get some information on what is to come in the future. So we're back live, and while those interviews were airing, I wish I would have just recorded the Zoom call that I just had, although there would have been some bleeps. It's not The Last Dance on ESPN where you're allowed to say anything you want in the Michael Jordan documentary, but, you know, Robin Miller was involved, so parental vision was required. But we had a good conversation. We've been visiting within our NBC group generally once a week. So it was me and Robin and Marty Snyder and Townsend Bell. This is Paul's nap time on the West Coast, so we don't get PT on these. He calls us individually. Our producer, Terry Lingner, Renee, our pit producer, and quite a few other people. Lee Diffie joined in just a few minutes ago before I hung up. So that was fun. I wish I could air that for you, but maybe one of these days I will record our part of our conversation and we'll just make that a segment. Some Twitter questions and comments. Chris Estes, thanks for the reminder of the Alex Barron. You know, I think before I even saw that, both Kurt and I remembered that it was Alex Barron that Ari was talking about. Chris Robertson, Indy Weather 3A. Indy 500 tradition demands 100% fan participation. Anything less would demand a derivation away from 500 miles. Well over 100,000 fans have an attendance streak that shouldn't be sacrificed. Yeah, it's going to be delicate. It's going to be delicate how this goes. Hopefully, you know, I know the experts all say there's no way we can gather in August in mass quantities, and they're probably right, or they may be right, that we could gather the way we have been. But you know what? There were some things said by medical experts in January and February that proved to be totally wrong. So we're playing this as it goes. And I'm still just hoping and praying that something that they don't think is going to happen on the positive happens here in the next 6 weeks or so. And maybe we've got a chance, or maybe it does get pushed back to October, because it's become clear that we can get things going fully again in October. Who knows? We'll have to wait and see, unfortunately. And with that, Chris Path 30 asks, when should we know Road America will be a normal event? I'm planning to fly out for the race. So the good thing, if you're flying, Chris, is that most of the airlines are allowing you to get refunds or change those flights without any penalty. Because I don't know that I would feel confident until at least we get 2 weeks out from the race. There's no way we're going to know if that race can have fans, I think, until we get to the beginning of June. Everything has changed here in the last few days in some areas of the country, so there will be a reassessment in 2 to 3 weeks. And if things are as they are now or better 3 weeks from now, then maybe you do have the full go. But if it's still unclear, then it's still flexibility is going to be the key to that. So I wouldn't book anything that you can't get your money back in this circumstance, because I think we're just going to have to be prepared to adjust. Hey, fans, and we all were at St. Pete. I thought once we got there, the event is going to happen in some fashion. And even then, that didn't happen. So we just don't know. Fleetwood Marky Moose says, have to admit, I'm glad we've reached the iRacing offseason. Seriously, how do you guys view Pagano's interaction with Norris? And even more seriously, how do you gauge the IndyCar paddock, or at least some drivers' true feelings for F1, or some of their drivers? This was a reveal to some extent. So to the second part, I don't know that I saw, maybe I missed it, because I don't really check Instagram that much, and I wasn't following Twitch this weekend at all. So I haven't seen IndyCar drivers' reaction to the Formula One side of things. As I said earlier, Formula One people take this seriously, way too seriously in many ways, but it was Team Lando all over, and Lando helped egg them on a little bit. Not that he suggested that anyone make any kind of threats, no, but it's hardcore over there. And maybe it does ramp up the rivalry a little bit between the two. Not that that's really going anywhere. I'm Team Simon, I admit, because I'm biased. I like Simon, and I know he wouldn't do anything like that in real life. And I think he did make a mistake, and if he had it to do over again, he'd do it differently. But I still believe he thought, I can just simply stay where I'm at. I don't know if he was pitting or not. I think he says he was planning to, and there have been some conversations that he even gave the signal that you can give an iRacing, hit a button and tells everyone that you're going to hit the pits. And maybe he did that, and that would help prove that in that case. But he ran over him. You know, I know he was going slower than Lando expected, but I think we all thought, well, he'll just go around him. It's not out of a blind corner at that point. And if he said he knew it was coming, he should have been aware something was going to happen in that regard. So veer to the right, and, you know, rightly or wrongly, and wrongly, Simon was hoping he could just slow him up a little bit, lose momentum, and that would be the end of his chance to win at that point. Let's see. What other questions have we? Nice comments. Sorry, Eric, I missed your question for Mark. If race teams have to follow Marion County orders before getting back in the race shops, and if they do, how that potentially affects the Texas date. I'll give my opinion on that. I don't think that impacts the Texas race, because I think if not now, some would be allowed in the shops now, and within 2 weeks, I think it's pretty much full go, even if there are some limitations. As we've talked about before, they're pretty much ready to race. Now, they're going to need to change the cars if they don't have the backup ready from street to oval, but they can do this in 3 or 4. They'd love to have 5 or 6 days to do it, but easily done in a week, because they do it within a week every time. So as long as they're in the shops by the end of the month, that would not be an impact on Texas. Other questions we have already. Oh, some questions for Donald Davidson. Okay, I see this. Perry, I'll hang on to that. Otherwise, you can start sending your questions for Donald, although we do think we're going to be able to take phone calls through the apparatus I'm hooked up to right now. It's a live broadcasting app that we've got Donald hooked up with, so we'll do that Thursday night from 6 until 7, and next Tuesday night, we'll get to the questions that I didn't get to on tonight's show. So thank you to Ari Leyendijk, thank you to Mark Miles, for Kirk Cavan, and Brad Huber back in our studios. We greatly appreciate you joining us. Stay safe, stay as separate as you possibly can, and we'll talk to you Thursday night at 6 for the talk of Gasoline Alley, May in Indianapolis on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.